Yeah, there was something about that song and what Mary was saying, and reminded me a line from the Talmud, of all places. If not now, when? If not you, who? Something like that. So I want to begin by reading from Annie Dillard, from her book called Tinker Creek. And here it is. When her doctor took off her bandages, and led her into the garden, the girl, who was no longer blind, saw, quote, the tree with the lights in it. It was for this tree I searched through the peach orchards of summer and the forests of fall and down winter and spring for years. Then one day I was walking along Tinker Creek and thinking of nothing at all, and I saw the tree with the lights in it. I saw the backyard cedar where the morning doves roost, charged and transfigured, each cell buzzing with flame. I stood on the grass with the lights in it, grass that was holy fire, utterly focused and utterly dreamed. It was less like seeing than like being for the first time seen. There's a typo here, so I'll read it again. It was less like seeing than like being for the first time seen, knocked breathless by a powerful glance. The flood of fire abated, but I'm still spending the power. Gradually, the lights went out in the cedar, the colors died, the cells unflamed and disappeared. And I was still ringing. I had been my whole life a bell and never knew it. Until at that moment, I was lifted and struck. I have since only very rarely seen the tree with the lights in it. The vision comes and goes, mostly goes, but I live for it, for the moment the mountains open and a new light roars in spate through the crack and the mountains slam. So last week I was driving into C3 the long way, and I passed a sign, and the sign said, quote, environmentally sensitive area. And the muse whispered something like, that's the name of your next talk. So I went with that, environmentally sensitive area. Someone informed me. I took that, of course, to be a pure creation of a pure symbolic myth right before me. Someone had the courtesy to tell me, they put those signs near blueberry bushes. And I thought to myself, that's good, because blueberries are quite sensitive. But of course, you know the question. What area is not environmentally sensitive? That could be my whole talk. You'd think that would be my talk. We have a sign that says environmentally sensitive area, and we're just supposed to say all areas are environmentally sensitive. See you next week. So, but I'm going to go a little further with that. It reminded me of another sign that also makes me laugh. Naturalized area. It's always between roads, too. Like, just that area is the naturalized area. Is that even possible? So these kind of questions lead to just some very basic ones that are hard to really dance with. But what is this world? I mean, that's what Annie Dillard and A Pilgrim at Tinker Creek is dancing with. What is this world? And what kind of area are we actually living in? And How aware are we of the place that we inhabit? Do we need signs that alert us? This is an environmentally sensitive area. This is a naturalized area. This is an environmentally insensitive area. Do we need these kinds of signs? And where does an area of sensitivity begin and end? You know? And Earth Day, of course, raises these kind of questions, at least for me. And what I'd like to say is that it's too simple to say the whole Earth is environmentally sensitive. Because sometimes big statements like that sound right because they are, but leave us with really nothing to do other than lament or write a Facebook post on your environmentally sensitive computer. So, let me first state a problem. One of the problems in trying to dance with some of these questions is what I might call the blessing and curse of separateness. Like the sign alerts us that we're separate from the world and that there is such thing as separateness because it's telling us this area is environmentally sensitive. Watch out, you're walking into it or driving past it at 65 miles an hour, or whatever the speed limit is, driving past at the speed limit, of course. It's the blessing and curse of separateness. And I'd like to say this is the gift of the ego. As ego selves, we experience a kind of separateness, which is, I'm saying, is a gift. It's a blessing and a curse, I'll get to in a second, but it is a kind of gift. And by ego, I mean something very specific and very simple in a way. By the way, this is a total aside. You may have heard me say this before, but I think it's interesting. Freud, our good friend Freud, and Jung never used the word ego or didn't use the word ego when they wrote in German. They used the word I in German. That's what they meant by ego. It's the I. Don't you have an I? You do have an I because you're thinking, I'm listening right now, or you're thinking, I'm not listening, or you're thinking about other things, like I wonder what's for small bites or whatever. That's the ego. That's the I. It's at work. And it's not wrong. It's a gift. It's a gift of being human. As far as we know, we're the only creatures that have an ego. There might be a small question mark with that, but we're the only creatures that have a human ego, we could say that. We're the only Homo sapiens that have a human ego, and it is a blessing and a curse, but it's just the I. By the way, where do we get then ego? Well, the translators, when they were translating it into English, thought, that sounds too easy to use the word I, so we're going to use the Latin to make it sound fancy. Thus we have ego. Anyway, it's the tip of our conscious awareness. It's what I'm aware of. And that's important, I might say. It's important to say something like, I am not that. I am not that. I am not like that, which some of you are fond of thinking when you read other people's Facebook posts. I'm not like that. I am not you, we would say. I'm not you. You are not me, or the tree is over there. I see lights on the tree. I see lights in the tree. See, the eye is at work here. And I'm not really saying anything super spiritual right now. I mean, I also mean by the eye, it's also your brain and your body and chemicals and synapses and cells. Isn't that also the eye? What else is the, if we unplug your brain, as far as we know, we don't need to get a whole debate about what happens after you die. We were doing that earlier in the pre-talk thing. But if we unplug the brain, you know, something of the eye goes. Wouldn't you agree? So there's a relationship here between our physicality and what we might call consciousness or the conscious tip here, the tip of the iceberg. That's the ego. I don't know if I'm a spiritual teacher. Depends on how we define these things. But I'm not the kind of person who always derides the ego. I get tired of that. The ego's the problem. The ego's the problem. Because most people who are doing that with the ego. It's the I making claims. Anyway. It's one of the gifts, I would say. And maybe what we might add to that is something that's happening in the 21st century is we now recognize, when we're paying attention, that our ego doesn't always know everything. it's been dethroned a little bit by saying, I'm not always, what's the right way of saying it, right. My perceptions, my eye is not always right. My perceptions can be wrong. I can read things incorrectly. I can hear things incorrectly. I can hear that you really said that to me and you really didn't say that to me. So the even the conscious tip of the iceberg here, the ego, is fallible. And that's a gift too, wouldn't you agree? So, the blessing part of having an eye is we can move through the world with some separateness. And with that comes a kind of imagination for things. If you and I are not the same, how are we going to relate? Or you start to have an imagination for the future. This is probably one of the things that makes Homo sapiens so dangerous, and also the fact that we're here after 2 million years of Homo erectus. You're here, in part because you have an imagination, and part of that imagination is rooted in the ego, and it can create if-then scenarios. If I save food, I'll live longer. My dog has never saved any food. The squirrels have figured that one out, I guess, but not the canine. Not really. So this kind of imagination, do you see, I'm just playing with here, that it is a kind of gift in a way. And we might add to that, sometimes our imagination for things, our if-then scenarios, are terribly wrong. Correct? We can be absolutely sure next week this is going to happen. You know, when I was a kid, people were absolutely sure Jesus was going to come back before the year 2000. I don't know why that makes me laugh. It just does. It's like, and he didn't come. So anyway, sometimes the eye and its imagination is wrong about things. And here's the curse part of the blessing and the curse. It's also terrible and awful to feel our separateness from things, isn't it? It is terrible to feel our separateness. On the one hand, it can be good and life-giving and imaginative and creative. And you can think, what shall I do before I die? And it's also terrible to feel our separateness, our disconnection from things. The cost is isolation in a way. Sometimes I think, this is a little bit of an aside, sometimes I think we look back at indigenous cultures, which really means rooted in a place, which we're all, I suppose, indigenous to a certain extent when we wander that trail backwards. We tend to say something like, well, they never experienced separateness from nature. And I think, I doubt it. Maybe they are indigenous ancestors, and maybe indigenous people who are still on this earth might feel more connection with what's real, with the natural world, we could say. But I think just part of the cost of having consciousness is the feeling of separateness from things. It's in all the myths and stories and fairy tales and legends and gods and goddesses. There's something of this thread. I'm not at home sometimes, and I'm searching for home. Like the meditation today. There's a thread that runs through there. That's the poetic and mythic expression of the separateness that we feel from life, from what's real. And I'd like to say that the curse is universal. And yet, sometimes the trees are on fire, like Annie Dillard is saying. And we're lit from within. And there's a bell that's struck. And there's a tuning fork that resonates with the primordial mystery of being. And separateness is an illusion. And we feel it. We experience it. That's what she's saying. I didn't go out and think pretty thoughts about the unitive nature of reality. For one moment, she just felt it. That's it. Minding her own business. She did say she was searching for the tree, but she didn't exactly say, I was searching for the tree at that moment I experienced the tree, but that the hunger, the longing for union, for connection, was a kind of aim, a driver, a director, an alluring lover in the night that was just pulling her. And then one day, her whole body was struck by something. And interestingly enough, she says, it felt less like I was seeing, but like I was being seen. That there was a witnessing, and the witnessing was passing both ways. Now, what kind of world is that? You might ask, which is it? Are we separate or are we connected? Is it separation and loneliness and isolation, or is it union, oneness, a kind of resonant mystery? Well, I might say, yes. It's something like that. It's something like both are present. Maybe that's what we would call the human condition. And I might say, at least in my opinion, that the kind of unitive experience that Annie's describing, by the way, later on in Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, she starts to say, the moment she begins to describe it, the quicker it evaporates. Which is the problem when you try to describe what we might call spiritual experiences or experiences of the numinous or the mysterious. They're very hard to name, and once you start to name them, they like evaporate. and they, you know, slip through your fingers like sand or something. But my point is, what she's describing, I would say, my opinion, is deeply human. It's ordinary. It sounds extraordinary, but it's actually quite ordinary. It doesn't happen that often, we might say, but it is just as natural of a human experience as when we experience our separateness, saying, I am not you. So we're sort of forced between this sort of paradox. And every once in a while, it's like the tuning fork is struck or the bell is rung. It's like Moses. This, by the way, is a contemporary version of the Moses story, the burning bush. Because it's not like he sees the bush that's on fire and says, well, that's what I always see. He sees that and thinks, I've never seen this before. And it's enrapturing in some way. And he feels like he has to take his shoes off. And it's like the ordinary becomes sacred for a moment. And he didn't see that before. And it's not only like seeing, but it's more like being seen. That's in the Moses story. It's like he's being witnessed by a kind of mysterious presence. Annie Dillard's just talking about a similar kind of thing, but in her own wildly unique way. Okay. I might say something about a personal hope I have, that all of us would taste such a thing. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't, I don't know. And that tasting such a thing shapeshifts us in some way, reforms and reshapes the I, the ego, what we think is real, our own ideas, our own thoughts, our own perspective, our own vision. It reshapes us a little bit. And I might also mention something here, which I'm going to call, for the time being, the folk tale of science. All right? So what's going on? Like, now, science, we could say, has been around since the Greeks, maybe earlier, a version of it. But really, in the 20th century, 20th century, it's become its own language. And it's a very important language. And it's a pretty new language. It's new on the scene. I like to refer to it as a folktale because it's still a symbolic language for talking about what's real. You say, well, it's not symbolic. What else is math than a kind of complex symbolism? How else are we going to express things? So my point is, right now, that science, the thing that at first told us we are separate from the universe and we're going to objectively look at it, and we can say this is not that, and this is not that, and we're going to name things, and we're going to separate ourselves out. That's how it started. Where it's going, or where it is at present, is saying something like, we are deeply intertwined in ways that our human minds cannot even fathom. That's the most contemporary expression of the folktale of science. Affirming what Annie Dillard is talking about, that there is in fact a bell that gets struck, a resonating, deeply intertwined connection between us and all things. We know that in a simple way, that we're exchanging breath with trees. I mean, you understand that logically, correct? You cannot breathe without trees. If we cut them all down, you die, all right? And we're exchanging breath. But she's describing a mystical experience of that kind of exchange, and science is coming along saying it's fundamentally the case, and that's actually much more mysterious than just exchanging breath with trees. And we might also say, we don't even know what we mean by the human eye anymore. There are particles in your body that are a billion years old. That doesn't make any sense. You were here before you were here. Some particle was here before you were here. Some particle will outlive you. Oh, you know? Too bad no one's ever thought about that before, except those who imagine things like reincarnation. All I'm saying is science has its own language, and spirituality has its own language, and religion has its own language, and we like to live with a kind of separation, and I like the tension between the two, but I just think we're in an interesting place where maybe we're being asked to speak out of, what's the phrase? Speak out of both sides of your mouth? Or something like that. Let these two languages harmonize instead of just create dissonance, which we've assumed they do. Okay, so that was my intro. Everything I will ever say from now on is just an intro. And then right before I die, I'm going to say that was the intro. Okay. So I want to just ask some really simple things. Like, what are we doing here at C3? Like, why are you here? Like, you're sitting in your little chair and, you know, you're, I don't know, doing things. Why are we really here? What is the point of a spiritual community, really, in which we have no agreed upon doctrines? And some of you believe in God, and some of you do not believe in God, and some of you are not sure about God. And why would we get together each week and wrestle with certain things and talk about our values and what we share and what we don't? And why would we do that? And what's the point of a really small community here on the shores of a massive freshwater lake? I mean, what kind of change could we possibly hope to help be a part of? After all, we're not promising eternal salvation or something. I'm not, at least. Or certain rewards in the afterlife or something like that. So I jotted down a few subtle reasons for why we might gather like this. And so here they are. So I think one reason why we should get together is to get close to naming and being affected by the tension between separateness and union. Okay? So I'll say it again. Why would we put ourselves in this kind of scenario? To stir the pot like this, like a cauldron. Well, to get close to the tension between separateness and union. And to let those two ends of the tuning fork start to hum a bit. Something like that. And I think, to me, that's the kind of modern spirituality that's needed. One that's caught between this kind of tension. See, if you worship one versus the other, you miss something. Like, you could say, it's all about union, separateness is an illusion, and then you go home, and then you sit there, and you watch Netflix, and you're like, that didn't cut it for me, and you feel alone for a moment. There it is. Or you could say, Union is an illusion, a bunch of spiritual crap. People like Eckhart Tolle, blah, 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 stay in the now, stay in the moment. It's all about facts. And then one day, you're out for a walk, and you're in the tree, and the tree is in you. And the whole earth is on fire, and you didn't plan it. So, yeah, that kind of thing. Let's amplify the tension between these things. Why come to C3? To amplify the tension. And for what purpose? Because it reshapes the I, the ego. And would you agree, not you, but let's first agree with other people, that their ego needs some help? That the ego needs to be expanded. Like Rilke says, I live my life in widening circles that move out across the world, where it's possible to live your life in a narrowing of that, like you're going down the drain. All right, so we want something else. I want something else. I'd like to live my life in widening circles. And part of that means a confrontation, that the ego needs to be confronted and challenged and changed and shape-shifted. And what kinds of things do that? Experiences of separateness and experiences of union and the tension between the two. And that's why we have unusual talks here. And we invite interesting people and we listen to interesting kinds of music. Not so that we can be affirmed, like every time it's just so great. Look at us. One hell of a place, you know? No, it's like so that something gets disturbed from time to time, you know? So that our own ego, our own I expands just a little bit. Okay, here's another reason. I only have four, all right? You can come up with your own list. To proclaim that all areas are environmentally sensitive. But not too easily, you know, not too easily. Yeah, all areas are environmentally sensitive, even the human heart. I mean, you're an environment too, and you're an environmentally sensitive area, I can tell. And that's a good thing. And what if we lived with that kind of sensitivity toward other people's environmental status? And how far out would that extend? And you have to start small, you really do. You have to say, the wetlands that I'm living in is environmentally sensitive. I have to say, the land that I'm currently inhabiting that the bank owns is environmentally sensitive. It is. And what if I open myself relationally to a particular place? How would that change me as much as the place? That kind of reciprocal change. So why come to C3? To remind us of things like that. And to encourage one another in this kind of sensitivity. Okay, here's the third reason. To put ourselves in conversation with science and spirituality. I just like both. Like, there they are. Maybe you heard that story about the rabbi who carries one stone in his pocket that says, you are the center of the universe, and a stone in the other pocket that says, you are dust. You know, that I love these kinds of tensions. It's like that with science and spirituality. You know, I think the same thing. Just put one in one pocket and one in the other, and let the tension amplify. Let yourself be disturbed and moved. After all, they're just two languages anyway, trying to describe what we might call ultimate reality, even though we know it's evasive, and the human ego is not God in the end. So, okay, fourth reason. We should get together from time to time to remind ourselves that there is a craving for the kind of seeing that Annie Dillard's talking about. A craving. There's a hunger for that kind of union, for that kind of taste. And we know it's a taste, yet the hunger is there. And like when Drew was playing that song, I could feel the hunger. It's like, there it is. I feel hungry for, or thirsty for, that kind of meaning and depth and that kind of taste. Just a taste will do. And we get together to say, to lament that sometimes there's only a taste, but also to remind ourselves that there's a taste. Maybe to use Dillard's words here. I stood on the grass with the lights in it. The grass was holy fire, utterly focused, and utterly dreamed. It's like she's being dreamed. Now, whatever kind of unitive hint she's talking about, I'm calling a kind of craving. And I hope at C3 we make the craving worse for you. We turn it up, you know, and we say, yeah, I hunger for that kind of thing, that kind of elusive thing. It's why I like the phrase a spiritual community, because it's a funny phrase. Like if people say, what's C3? I say it's a spiritual community. That's kind of like saying nothing at all, you know? Like, okay, it's a spiritual community. Talk to you later. Sounds like a cult. On the other hand, here's what I mean by it, that it says that we're open to the possibility of being shaped like this, shaped by the unseen and the unknown and the mystery and the numinous and the taste. We're just open to that possibility. And maybe we'd like to walk in the world with that kind of posture that's open to that sort of sensitivity. That used to be called prayer. Prayer was the posture that you took. Not like the words that you say. I mean, those might matter or not matter, I don't know. But it's a posture, like, how may I walk in the world with a kind of openness and sensitivity that I might be struck like a bell out of the blue? I'd like to walk like that. And at least that's one of my jobs, I think, to, like our spiritual ancestors have done, to sort of echo down through the canyons of time and saying, being a human being is complex and it's beautiful and its separateness and its union. And what if you could walk with a kind of sensitivity toward the mystery of being itself? Yeah. And when this happens, what Dillard describes here, it's a gift. It's a gift. And we come, I think, to know a little bit more of what it means to be a human being by tasting such a thing. So, thanks for listening.